All right. Hi, everybody, and welcome to our kind of open forum webinar where you can ask any question you like or make any comment, but who knows whether you'll really get an answer, but we'll do our best. You know, all I can do is share my point of view on certain things, and we maybe have some faculty members, too, with us that might be willing to chime in and share their perspective on something that you may ask. So as we begin, I'd like to that all of us do our great invocation. You know, basically, I'll probably be leaving you on mute for the most part, because when I unmute everybody, it makes a huge cacophony. You know, the some people don't have headphones, and the computers echo and all that kind of thing. But I'll welcome you in just a moment, and but first let us do the great invocation together, and that will be the way that we will start. An om and then three oms, great invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. Make Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Okay, thank you, friends, and let's see who's here. Jocelyn, Yoke, let's see, Kim, Linda Arnelis, Mary Bell, Malia, Michael, Nolene, Walter, Yvonne, and I know, you know, as we go along, maybe others will join us, and I think you all know how to raise your hand, don't you? It's right there on your dashboard, and when you have a question, you can speak it out loud, or maybe you can type it in if you wish, and one of the staff members will help me register that. Okay, I just want to make sure that you can see everybody as much as possible. Yep, you can. Okay, as far as I can see. Good. Well, I tell you what, I had a couple of questions that were sent to me, and I could begin with those, and then, you know, you can think about what you'd like to discuss as we go along. This is an open forum, and in a way, anything goes, almost anything. So this first question, a couple of questions came from England, and it was about service, especially in these years preceding 2025. Alex has written this. I wonder if you could speak about our service in general, clarifying its definition. Well, you know, we are familiar with the idea that service is the result of soul contact. It's a spontaneous radiation of what we actually are. I mean, we can, in a way, do service. We can use the third aspect of divinity. We can do many things that are helpful, and all of that has to be part of it. In these modern times, the person who thinks they can serve only by meditating is, I think, perhaps out of step. Maybe some of the high initiates can do that, as Master Maurya tells us. You know, the yogi in his cave reaches out across the entire world. But we actually have to do something. But maybe even more important is what we are. We have to be something. We have to be in contact with our soul, and whatever we do, whatever we say, and in our presence, that soul radiation has to come through and will touch the soul of others and kindle in them a similar kind of radiation, which will be really the expression of love, wisdom. Goodwill as love in action. And then, you know, along the seven ashramic lines or the 10 seed group lines, everybody will find their specific thing that they have to do. We working with Master DK under his supervision, we tend to work a lot in the field of education and healing and the New World religion and in the area of psychology. There are other areas, of course, and you know, you have to choose your own according to your ray inclinations, your inner voice, your inner conscience. He says, we do know, she says, but it would be good to hear you speak of it. I'm asking this because I have a deep sense that my very first and most significant service has to do with transforming myself, those unredeemed aspects, and more especially what I am emanating out in the daily world. Well, you know, the Buddha had quite a powerful saying. He says that he who conquers himself is as one who conquers a thousand armies. We know how elusive is the elemental personality self and how it tries to get away and still do what it is inclined to do, which is not in the direction that the soul would have it go. So, look, you know, we have this whole thing about the path of probation. We are being tested all the time. Maybe until one is an accepted disciple, maybe somewhere between the first and second initiation, or closer to the second initiation, one is inclined to do what has to be done and is a probationary disciple until one is truly accepted. You know, in other words, we're tested. That's what probation means. So, indeed, we have to clean up our act. When you look at the what's called the Acklery formula in esoteric psychology, it goes alignment, which causes a crisis, and the crisis produces light. And the light generally shines on the not-self and shows all the areas of our customary self, which are often in the way of what we're really trying to do with souls. And then comes revelation of the divine plan. But until we've managed to get rid of some of these illusions and glamours, the real picture of the divine plan cannot come through. So I would say yes, we're always being tested, and we always have to continue to work upon the not-self, the self working upon the not-self. Meantime, of course, soul radiation. See, we don't want to get so involved that all we ever do is think introspectively about what's wrong with me. That wouldn't be the right way to go. But when we use occult meditation and we bring the soul power through, then, in fact, we are in a position to cleanse the Augean stables, just like Hercules did in the 11th labor. You know, he released the Alpheus and Peneus, two important energy streams, and he cleansed the filth of 30 years, the whole idea of what the personality has accumulated. There's a whole bunch of stuff down at the bottom of the aura, you know, and it gets stirred up, and we have to dissipate it and find a way to cleanse that. So, yes, I would say that is a very great service. And let everybody, I'm remembering this, the story goes, Roberto Assagioli, he was the disciple F.C.D. in the Tibetan groups. He was freedom from ties, chelaship, see, and detachment. These were his words. So on his deathbed, he was said to have said, make sure they do their personal work. You know, because so many of us want to leap right into what we call spirituality, and we have what some people call a spiritual bypass. And we suddenly start thinking of the soul before we've cleaned up the stuff in the personality that prevents the soul from really coming through, prevents the higher energy. So yes, I would say it's very important to work upon the self, the not-self. I like to call it the not-self. People say, well, take care of yourself. And I say, well, myself is not the problem. It's my not-self that's the problem. So, okay, is there anybody that has any comments they would like to make in relation to this first question? You are welcome to do so if you like. I'll look for your hands, and if I don't see them, then the staff members here, Kay and Joe and Brett, hopefully they will see them. Anything you would like to say about this, or any question that might be related to this question of service being a soul radiation? It's the spontaneous result of soul radiation. Okay, anybody? Okay, so it looks like a couple of questions are turning up there. Joe or Kay, could you tell me what they are? Because every time I go try to find them, I lose my place. It looks like Nolene has something and Yvonne Wegner has something. Yeah.
Nolene's computer is being used by Alex in England, and Alex says, thank you.
Okay, good, Alex. Okay, good. Thank you.
Yvonne's is a question. She says, Alcyon, cosmic logos, question mark, please explain.
Alcyone. Well, Alcyone, yeah, okay, Alcyon, however you want to pronounce it. The central star, sort of the first ray star in a third ray cluster called the Pleiades, and it's a cluster which may have about 1,000 stars. Already they're counting in the 800s somewhere there. And it's a very good analogy to the 1,000-petaled lotus of the what we call our local, not just cosmic logos, but I call it our local supercosmic logos. So we call it the one about whom naught may be said, which means maybe we can't say anything about it. But wait a second, I'll kind of show you where this comes from. If I go back here to page 344 of A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, we will see that the seven stars of the Great Bear seem to emanate onto the Buddha plane, they really should be also on the Atmic plane, from this little green triangle. And also our own solar logos has a point of emanation from this little green triangle. I do believe that this little green triangle represents the our local one about whom naught may be said. And I believe its center is the Pleiades. The Pleiades, as a 1,000-petaled lotus, kind of the great head center, the greatest head center in this one about whom naught may be said. Now, there is also we have seven major stars there, of which Alcyone is the central star. I wouldn't call it a cosmic logos. It really is a solar logos, a deity that works through a particular star is the solar logos, even though that star may be vast. If you work through a constellation, the deity is a cosmic logos. And if one works through a group of constellations, like the one about whom naught may be said does, it's a super cosmic logos. So Alcyone is a central star in this important cluster called the Pleiades, and the seven major stars, plus their parents, I forget, Atlas and Pleione, I think that's who they are, that makes nine, that sevenfoldness may make the jewel in that head center. Like every one of us in our head center, we have a central jewel, and all jewels have seven facets. And when you look at those seven stars, including Alcyone, they may be the jewel in the head center of this great being. Of course, it's a vast being, and our local stars are part of it, and the Great Bear is part of it, and the Little Bear is part of it, and Orion is part of it, and the Southern Cross, and the Dragon, and all of that. It's a huge being, and yet, from a certain perspective, it's just this tiny little triangle, as far as I can understand, out of which seven or ten major constellations come. So these circles here are even bigger beings than our local one about whom not may be said. These circle, I call them sub-parabrahmic logoi. And then at the top of it all, on the cosmic logoic plane, is what they call a cosmic parabrahman. But that, of course, is simply it's not anywhere near as big as a galaxy, and on it goes. We don't have charts for what all would be involved in the so-called 10 dimensions of cosmos. But Alcyone is a solar logos. It's a central star of a very important cluster in this great supercosmic logos, and around Alcyone, or really around the Pleiades, our entire solar system and several other solar systems are said to revolve once every 250,000 years. That's what occultism says. Now, a lot of astronomers say, well, that's not possible, but nevertheless, in the secret doctrine and with hints from DK, there seems to be something to it. Hope that covered your question. Cosmic logos, remember, is a constellational logos. When you take our sun, take Sirius, take Procyon, take Alpha Centauri, maybe Fomalo, take Altair, maybe take Vega, put them all together and they may be the seven major stars in our local cosmic logos, of which our sun is the heart center. Okay. So we have your question there. Any questions on that question? Anything anybody wants to add or further clarify? And Joe and Kay, I'll rely upon you to let me know. So I'll tell you what, if nothing comes up immediately, I'll go to my next question here from Alex and her group there, and it's all about evil, you know. Well, yeah, the thing is about this subject, of course, DK says of it, he says, speculation anent which is both profitless and dangerous. So there's not, he says quite a bit about cosmic evil and planetary evil. Cosmic evil is deliberate. Planetary evil is simply based on ignorance and can be outgrown. The other one is deliberate, and the forces of evil are pretty much found on the cosmic astral plane, along with great forces of love, of course. But they are a deliberate and dedicated selfishness. And, you know, we're not going to be confronted ourselves very much with what we call the Black Lodge, even in a planetary sense, because we're just little pipsqueaks. We don't count for much. They are working in much subtler ways with the politics of the world, the religion of the world, and the economics of the world. Those are the three areas, Ray 3 and 6, where I think there's a really, really big problem. And they work by fostering glamour, which is distortion, you know, exaggeration, minimization. They work with Maya, which is confusion and chaos. Nobody knows what's going on. And they work with illusion, which are fragmenting thought forms, which prevent us from really seeing the unity of things. How do we deal with this? Well, we make sure our heart center and our love is very, very strong. As Master Moria said, you know, you're not going to have to worry about the dark, obsessing forces when your heart center is really active, because it drives away through love these particular forces. But when we are suspicious, when we are critical, what's the other one? Suspicion. Oh, yeah, self-pity. Must be mine, you know, because I forgot it. But when we have self-pity, suspicion, and now what was the other one? I just mentioned it. Well, anyway, those glamorous things, they make us vulnerable. So we don't really have to worry about evil so much in that sense. What we have to worry about is cleaning out our own energy system of the Maya glamour and illusion we find within ourselves. That is a most necessary stage. We're not even fit to deal with evil on a planetary level until we've done that, because there will always be points of entry for those forces if we haven't dealt with our own problems. And yes, as 2025 nears, these will increase. Because, you know, it is said that in 2025, in all probability, plans will be laid by the hierarchy for the first stages of the externalization. I don't by any means expect the Christ to appear at that time. I think it's too early, considering all that has to be done in terms of the five planetary centers and all the work that has to go on in those centers with a master at each one, surrounded by disciples, recognized by the governments of those countries as valuable sources of information. So much has to be done yet. But let's just say by 2025, plans will be laid for the first stages of the externalization, and you can sure bet that the counterforce is going to fight that in every way possible with all kinds of disinformation, fear, chaos, terror, you know, all kinds of brutality. And it's going on in the world today, right now. People don't know who they are, and they're just run by their astral body and their mental body serving their astral body, and this is the case with the masses. So we, who are representing the ageless wisdom, have to stand steady in the light, and in any way we can, we must serve by bringing the ageless wisdom out to people in a way they can digest it, so that, in fact, it can win the day by the end of the 21st century. It won't be long after that that the true age of Aquarius will begin in 2117. That's the figure that has been given to us. So how to meet the opposing forces? Just meet them within yourself first, and use the power of love in your environment. Live sacrificially in a loving way, and in an illumined way in your local environment and with anyone you touch, and you won't have to, that's the first step. After that, you know, if we merit, have the distinction of meriting the attention of some of these greater counterforces, we'll know about it when it happens. But for the moment, most imagination that one is up against some kind of Black Lodge member, the rest of it is just glamour in itself. So let us deal with our own nature first, and that will bring about such an improvement that a lot of beauty will be reflected in our environment, a lot of improvement, and that's what we should concentrate on, is simply doing the good, the true, and the beautiful. Any
Michael?
Questions? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, there's yes. A question Walter would like to pose. Would you care to unmute him? His audio usually works pretty well.
Okay, yes, Walter, go ahead.
Yes, I had a question about the new moon, and specifically, are new moons as significant in our practice as full moons? In other words, do new moons also cover 7 days of importance with like 3 days of confidence, aspiration, and dedication before, and another 3 days of registration, sense of expectancy and belief after?
Okay, well, you know, Deke hasn't emphasized it in the same way, but the new moon is kind of a, we might call it a shambolic moon. So, you know, in one respect, it represents practical action in the world, and that's how the Lucis Trust has used it. You know, when I used to work there, we stopped doing only full moons. We started doing new moons as well, and we brought in members of the new group of world servers. DK had not emphasized it in the same way, but he said to take advantage of it. But there's a much deeper kind of will impact that can occur in a much more subjective way at the new moon. And I think this can be developed. When you look at eclipses in astrology, the most powerful eclipses are the new moon eclipses. They are really a jolt along the will line. Sometimes the full moons are much more about conscious realization. The new moons are into the power aspect. DK hasn't emphasized using the seven-day period, but my guess is that the masters do precisely that, and that they use those periods in ways that are very, very effective for bringing in the divine purpose. So we haven't emphasized it in the same way, but I think it would not be a bad thing if it were. Of course, it makes a person very busy in that sense. The masters are said to use the whole month. You know, they use the whole cycle up to the they prepare for the full moon, and then they subside and they work towards impression at the new moon. And it's kind of like the higher and the lower interlude from a certain perspective. We might call, from one perspective, the full moon as the higher interlude with impression and consciousness. We might call the new moon a forceful impact in the lower interlude, a magical time of impressing the will upon conditions. I think that's what I would say about it. Anything further on that, Walter?
No, that is interesting. So it almost seems like that the full moon is maybe more second aspect or consciousness or love-based, while the new moon is more will power-based.
Yes, will and action. It's like the 1-3 kind of thing. You know, it's about manifestation and will and purpose, and I think the full moon is really about illumination. You know, if you think about it, the symbolism of it, you know, to have the full moon is illumination. And of course, in another way, the form disappears in the new moon. So, you know, blotting out all form, you know, we get right into rule 9 there, you know. Let the group know there are no other selves, let the group know there's no color, only light, and then let darkness take the place of light, hiding all difference, blotting out all form. That's what really happens at the new moon eclipse. So it's very shambolic in that sense. I know, you know, that you will work it out so that it is satisfactory to you. Right now we've been concentrating on the full moons. It's just a question of how much one can do. Okay, Walter. All right. Now, maybe while other questions are cooking, I have another question here that, gosh, I should remember who this is from. It came off of Facebook, and it's a group that does astrology, and the lady's name is S. And I'm just, well, please forgive me, S, for not remembering your full name, but I can only answer one of the questions, the others I can't. So, we've been following your webinars on esoteric astrology, thank you. I have a question on where the information on stepping off the fixed cross into or onto what or where to the fourth initiation, then mounting the cardinal cross may be found. So if you can find something, can you reply? Well, I think I found an important quotation. There are different quotations that make it seem sometimes as if one can mount the cardinal cross shortly after dismounting the fixed cross at the third degree, but this is the most authoritative. Oh, it's Shirley. That's who it is. All right. Okay, Shirley, that's it. So this is the quotation. The cardinal cross governs the master as he passes through the remaining five initiations. I suppose remaining five. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, maybe? Yes, I suppose so. Those are the remaining five. The fourth initiation, and this is the point that I think Shirley was after here and her group, the fourth initiation is, curiously enough, governed by neither the fixed cross nor the cardinal cross. The disciple is descending, it's a process, right, descending from the fixed cross with its sole emphasis and seeking to mount the cardinal cross, but hasn't done it, see? And it is this transition period and experience which practically govern him, presumably at the fourth initiation. It might therefore be noted that there are three initiations which test the disciple as to knowledge and experience. The first, the second, and the third, then comes an initiation of transition, which is, well, sometimes actually the eighth initiation is called transition, but here DK means the fourth initiation. Then comes an initiation of transition, followed by five initiations which the master undergoes upon the cardinal cross. So no cardinal cross until the fifth initiation, and the discontinuance of the fixed cross at the third initiation, so you're kind of in that no man's land, where you're utterly dependent on yourself. Even my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Even the solar angel, in a sense, is no longer supervising. So you have to draw upon your own triadal and monadic powers. And this is the dark the real dark night of the soul is likely to occur at this time. And DK says we feel abandoned and bereft of all that had sustained us. What had sustained us, of course, was the solar angel, but it wings its way back to the heart of the sun, and we have risen to the feet of the solar angel at the time of the fourth initiation, so we have to take care of ourselves. The soul does not support us, and the completeness of monadic infusion, which happens at the fifth degree, or the great majority of it at the fifth degree, is not yet ours. So we have to rely upon all we have accumulated, all that is being transferred into the spiritual triad. It's a pretty lonely initiation, and one which is, Mercury, Saturn, and Vulcan especially. Vulcan especially is involved in the loneliness. Saturn is involved in all the trials. Mercury is involved in the Buddhic transition, the transition to the fourth subplane, where the consciousness will focus once the fourth degree has been completed. And Pluto, of course, and Vulcan help to bring about the death of the causal body. So we're on our own, much more than at the earlier initiation supervised for the solar angel, and much more than when we have that full monadic power on which we can really rely, depend, and have confidence. So that's what I could answer there, Shirley, about that. Now, I don't have in front of me the chart of Foster Bailey. I know he's a Pisces with Gemini rising, and he has a moon in Taurus the way so many of those more advanced disciples did in the Alice Bailey group. So I haven't followed Philip's last newsletter about this, and I don't have the cycle chart of Foster Bailey in front of me, but I do know he was a first-ray soul, a second-ray personality, and a fourth-ray mind, a second-ray astral body, and a seventh-ray physical body. And in his case, I think Pluto was very much operating through his Pisces energy, but the second-ray aspect of Gemini was reinforcing his second-ray personality and adding that quality of love and wisdom, which he needed to increasingly cultivate, to his general expression. I'm sorry, but I don't have any cycle chart to speak of. Okay, Shirley, that's what I can do on the questions that you asked. Okay, friends, now, what additional things would you like to consider? What's on your mind? What's important to you? What should be important is to get ourselves in shape for the last 10 years here, last 11 years, of the era of the forerunner. We have till 2025, you know, and it's not going to be an easy time, because anything the counterforce can throw at the forces of light is going to be thrown. So it's what DK calls the fighting to the last ditch, the so-called last ditch fight of materialism. Materialism is a state of perception. It is a state of veiled perception. And when that type of perception can be dissipated, then people will see things as they really are. And we people who are in the ageless wisdom, you know, we can help people see things more as they are. We have a lot of clarifying of consciousness to help people with. And, don't overlook an opportunity. I was in Mary Bailey's house one day, and we were talking about masonry and other things, and a guy comes to the door, he's delivering something, and suddenly, you know, she was at the door, and suddenly she said something to him, and I forget what it was, unfortunately, but it was very wise, and it was just, it just came out of nowhere, and she just said it to him. You know, he kind of registered it, and then he went on his business, and then she turned to me and she said, "Always plant a seed." She says, "I never lose an opportunity to plant a seed." And this is a seed of wisdom, you know. So any little thing, anybody you're talking to, any place, any thought, you know, we can be working all the time on improving conditions. Any thoughts or questions on anything?
There's a question that Kim Kwan Ho has posed. He asks,
okay.
Can you tell us more about the solar angel? Because he hasn't seen as much material on this.
Kim, there's a lot of material on the solar angel. But it's scattered, you know. And actually, I'm some of the work that I have done. I've done a series of commentaries, video audio commentaries on the Angel of the Presence, and you can find them on Makara. And now I'm working on the Egoic Lotus, and a series of commentaries for this Egoic Lotus book, and I've completed about 21 programs. And so Brett is helping me get these on Makara too. But everybody always has a question about the Solar Angel, and I don't blame them. DK said, look, you're not going to solve this problem. He says, you cannot solve this problem, but I'll tell you a few things that I am fairly sure of. A Solar Angel was a human being in a previous solar system. A Solar Angel has been to the star Sirius for training, moving out of the fourth creative hierarchy into the fifth creative hierarchy, which is sacrificial. The majority of human beings, maybe 80% on our planet, will take the path to Sirius and will become solar angels. A solar angel is called a returning Nirvani from a previous Mahamanvantara, so one solar system ago. They are beings who are focused largely on our Buddhic plane. I'll show you here. Right here, I think, yeah. Okay. This is the table of creative hierarchies found in Esoteric Astrology, page 35. Notice, solar angels, Buddhic plane. But they've already been to the cosmic astral plane for their training. So they have fallen twice out of service. They've fallen down into the cosmic physical plane on its fourth level, which we call the Buddhic plane. It's the plane of intuition, of harmony, of love, wisdom, of pure reason. And then they fell further yet. They extended themselves into the dense physical body of the solar logos. Now, that dense physical body of the solar logos is our lower 21 planes. And they have taken up residence with a fragment of themselves. There's an old saying from the Bhagavad Gita, having pervaded the entire universe with a fragment of myself, I remain. So they remain on their own high plane, doing their own things involving spiritual telepathy, but they are capable of projecting a fragment of their presence, containing light, love, and power, into the mind of animal man. From that place, they can begin to supervise. They also are underlying the matter of the higher mental plane and have created the form of an egoic lotus, which starts out very small but gradually expands. This egoic lotus, after maybe 25 million years of work, is ready to take the fourth initiation. But the solar angel is underlying all of that as what is called the angel of the presence. Now, in my view, anyway, now I stand to be corrected as always, but the solar angel is the greater being which remains on its own plane. That which it projects into the higher mental plane and which is sort of its presence within us is called the angel of the presence. And it gradually introduces us to our own presence, which is the monad. So when we come in touch with our own higher ego nature, the solar angel, as the angel of the presence, is underlying that. And it's constantly sending out streams of love and wisdom and intelligence and power into our personality, mind, and brain, if we could pick them up. So in occult meditation, we always are cognizant of the solar angel. We try to contact it. We try to bring in these streams so that we can develop that angelic power of expression in our own lower form. Now, gradually, as we work down here in the 18 lower subplanes, we bring quality to the egoic lotus, and it fills out in something very beautiful. But at the same time, the solar angel, from its own type of power, is sustaining and upholding and feeding the egoic lotus. And so is our own spiritual triad, and so is our monad. So let's just say the solar angels are called by many, many different names. You know, I wonder if I dare, let's see if I dare do this. I'll give you some kind of idea if I don't get myself in a lot of trouble here, going off the track. I have these things called AAB extracts. It's a bunch of, lot of references, and let's see, if I put down solar names of the solar angel, let's see if I can get this, and if I can't get this, I'll just solar angel, etc., the army of the voice, etc., just be patient with me here, and I will try to find this. Actually, what I think I'll do, Ray Lord names, extracts, etc. I think what I'm going to, here we go. Here's one. Names for the solar angels. All right, look at these. It's fantastic what they do, and the names hold the hint. Sons of Wisdom, aggregate of the Ahi, they're found in the secret doctrine. Agnishvatas, okay, having to do with the plane of air, which is Buddhi. Asuras, really they should be called Suras. Asuras means not having the sun, but, you know, they've not always been popular because they tend to disrupt the ancestral gods, so they get a bad name. Builders of the body of the ego, builders of the egoic body, or same thing, Dhyanic, Chohanic forces, fire Dhyanis, lords of the flame, Manasa Devas, planetary spirits, producers, now these are all DK's words, they're not mine, producers of realized consciousness, producers of individualization, Prometheus, even Satan in the higher sense. You know, also Satan is not the devil. Satan is something else. It's the luminous host which bestowed mind upon animal man. The solar angels, of course, sons of mind, the great devas of mind, the self-conscious principles, the vehicles of the divine mind. Maybe there are other names, too. The point is, yeah, there are. I forgot the hearts of fiery love. So that's somewhere here. I have several lists. Hearts of fiery love is a very, very important one. And they are supervising us all the time. From the time we start working on the fifth petal, which is the love petal, the solar angel becomes a downward-gazing soul as the angel of the presence and really begins to work in meditation with the man that the solar angel is supervising. And from then on, there's a lot of attention paid until finally the egoic lotus is destroyed. So let's just say, Kim, that the big theme of Madame Blavatsky was the solar angel theme. It's the major thing she's talking about. And DK has written so much about it, but it's obscure, it's scattered. We are not the solar angel. The solar angel is infusing our higher consciousness so that we can make the bridge between our lower nature and our higher nature much more rapidly than would be possible otherwise. And we need this because there was a failure to complete that bridge on the moon chain. It's a vast subject, but the main thing is when we meditate, we bring this luminous presence into our mind. It brings in all of the beautiful qualities. It makes for the soul-illumined mind. It's a very practical thing to come in touch with your solar angel. And, you know, the appearance of our egoic lotus can look like a like a flower. It can look like a spoke with nine wheels, or it can look like an angelic presence. And at our initiations, the solar angel as an angelic presence does show up and is part of that. So, you know, it's a huge subject, but I hope a couple of things that I said maybe will straighten out the idea that we can have a direct relationship with this supervising deity who is a heart of fiery love and is seeking to lift us up toward the Buddhic plane.
Kim okay, says, Kim. Thank you very much. And we have two more questions. The first is from Mary Bell. She asks,
yes,
if you define the Grand Cross activity.
Oh, gosh, I should leave that to Lawson, you know, and all these other astrologers. well, a cross is great for tearing you apart or for creating synthesis. So let's just say that Uranus, which is the new, the archetype, is opposing Mars, which is the instinctual nature, and all of the fighting of the personality to retain its own rights. So all these new ideas are fighting against these old methods of demanding your personality rights. Pluto is the destroyer of everything that gets in the way of the proper structure. So it's tearing down the old governments. And Jupiter in Cancer opposing it is giving us this sense of oneness and understanding of why it's necessary to tear down all of these old structures that do not work. There's been so much written about this lately. You know, I'm not the expert on this, but what I would do is think of the best you can get out of the four factors and how to synthesize them. So when I look at Uranus and Aries, I say, okay, the new archetypes are coming in. They are part of the divine purpose. Get them in your mind and institute them and begin to magically work with their imposition. Pluto is in Capricorn. Tear down the old walls and get rid of the hell nature of humanity. Raise it up into the light of day and use the spiritual will to build the new structures which are in line with the divine plan. Mars is in Libra. There's a lot of battle with Mars in Libra, or it's a weak Mars, but I would say fight for the rights of others. In other words, it's not just your own rights. It's the right that other people have when they, for fairness. Fight for justice, fight for fairness. Then comes Jupiter in Cancer. See wholeness. Bring the personality nature of all people into fulfillment. Have compassion, be inclusive, and out of all of the destruction that happens when the new archetypes come in and when the old walls are being torn down, build a humanity, a humanitarian wholeness out of things so that the whole can be seen as one. That's the way I like to look at it. I don't like to look at it and say, well, we're all falling apart. Of course, you know, a lot of people under the Grand Cross have a lot of pressure. They feel, how do I make that work with this? You know, everything is like being drawn and quartered, pulled in four different directions. But I say synthesis is to use the best of all four and spiral it up to a point, which is the pyramid which unites the Grand Cross. And that would have in it the great new ideas, the clearing away of the debris. It would have the sense of nobility to fight for justice and a real sense of wholeness and humanitarianism. That's what we can gather out of the Grand Cross. Other than that, Lawson gave a whole lecture on it, and so did other people. You know, I just gave you 5 minutes. Okay, Mary Bell.
Yvonne's question is, what's the difference between planting the seed and casting pearls before swine?
Let me get the first part. I got the pearls before swine. What was the first part? Difference between?
What's the difference between planting the seed and casting pearls?
Oh, judgment, judgment. Judgment. You have to know what to say. It's what Master Moria says, speaking proportionately to your interlocutor. It is your sense of where the person is at, registered immediately, intuitively, sensing what might be useful to that person, all intuitively, and then bringing forth that which is assimilable, instead of maybe taking your highest esoteric ideas and throwing them out there to someone who can't possibly appreciate them and will, in fact, throw them back at you and throw them down and rend them underfoot and all that. But, you know, most people aren't swine. Basically, people are good, and they want a better life. And, you know, there are people that you're just not going to talk about the ageless wisdom because you know they are dedicated to a contrary path. Maybe they are the swine we're talking about. But most people, they want a better life. And we have been so well educated in many ways that we might be able to offer a seed of thought that can contribute to a better life. And if not that, then some heart impulse, some kind gesture, something to go from us to them to help improve their life. But be careful, you know, you don't talk about cosmic fire to somebody who is dedicated against. I remember the Dalai Lama, you know, he was being interviewed by Mao Zedong. He was brought to China. Mao was so nice to him, so nice. That's what the Dalai Lama said. He couldn't get over how kind Mao was. But the Dalai Lama concluded at the end of the several days that Mao was the enemy of the Dharma. So what's the use, then, of offering the Dharma to one who is assessed as the enemy of the Dharma? So one has to be judicious in what one says, does, and thinks in the presence of others. Okay, Yvonne. Okay, other thoughts, friends? Other thoughts, other things you might like to discuss? Anything goes, you know. I don't have all the answers, but I'm willing to offer my thoughts if I've thought about it, and maybe they'll be of some use to you, and maybe not. But that's what these open forums are for. So you can write your question, or you can speak up. You can, yeah.
Walter has another question.
Okay, Walter. Okay, Walter is not on mute by me. So go ahead, Walter.
Yes, I wanted to inquire about the seven rays and really the nature of a ray. In other words, how distinct or discrete are the seven rays from each other? Like, mm-hmm. do rays gradually change from one to another, somewhat like the signs or the degrees around the zodiac? And are our bodies strictly of one ray, or can they be like mostly a ray and maybe a certain percentage of other rays?
Yes, I think so. I think that the body, the different vehicles, can have all the sub-rays potential within the permanent atom which built that body. It's just that one of them is emphasized. And I've often thought that the atoms of a particular body vibrate to distinct frequencies which are correlated with the seven rays, and that the proportion can change. Probably, you know, we all have one major ray for a vehicle, and that means that the majority of atoms of the vehicle are vibrating to that particular measure, but there is a secondary or subray where a significant number are vibrating to it, and probably it just goes down. The potential of all the rays exists in all the vehicles. I do think there is, in a way, a line of demarcation, but I can also give you my sense of how they are formed. Excuse me. Out of the trinity of the first, second, and third ray, there arise combinations which I've looked at in this way, that the fourth ray is composed of a certain combination, I don't know the measure, okay, but of the second and first ray, that the fifth ray is a combination of the first and third rays, that the sixth ray is a combination of the second and third rays, and that the seventh ray, balanced like the seventh sign, is equal measures of the first, second, and third ray brought together for the sake of precipitation. So the rays of attribute in that sense derive from the rays of aspect. And all of the rays, you know, probably derive from the two, which derives from the one, which derives from the zero. So ultimately, they're all the same thing in the last analysis, but it's white light in the prism breaking out into seven distinct qualities. When it comes to our own microcosmic system, things are changing all the time. And our personality ray can change so that towards the end of life, we may have the personality ray that we will have in our next life. There was an individual in DK described how he's a six-ray personality now. By the end of this incarnation, he is to have the first-ray personality. He is to have it, the first-ray personality, which he will have in his next incarnation. And then after that, it was scheduled as second-ray. So maybe by the end of that, he was a third-ray soul. So by the end of the first-ray personality incarnation, he will have worked his way into the second-ray. The astral body is always changing. Generally, when you have a first-ray astral body, which only a disciple can have, it has to work itself into either a sixth-ray or a second-ray astral body. So the rays are fluid in terms of their dynamics with each other. Rays are qualitative, too, and they are defining the seven major qualities of deity, and they really emanate from the monadic source. Of course, when we say that the monad has a ray, we don't mean the heart of the monad. The heart of the monad has no ray, because being has no ray. Being is all-inclusive and has all of the rays. It is the white light, so to speak. And the many-colored, the dome of many-colored glass is staining with seven colors what's called the white radiance of eternity. This is, you know, the Shelley poem. So I don't think we're going to find that kind of like a overlap, one slides into two slides into three, the same way as we do the zodiac, where the 2.5 degrees on either side are kind of a no man's land where we share the same share the same qualities. I don't find that so much with the rays, but of course there are lines of relationship between the rays and similarities. 1, 3, 5, 7, 2, 4, 6. Okay, that's obvious. But then he says, 2 ones are a 2. Okay, that's the relationship between the first and second ray. 2 twos are a 4. The second and fourth ray, very closely related in many ways. And 2 threes are a 6. And when you look at the 3 and the 6, you find many qualities in common. Activity, for instance. When you look at the 2 and 4, you find magnetism in common. When you look at 2 and 1, it's a little harder, but let's just say that the factor of purpose is common to both of them, because purpose is a first ray, second ray factor, at least in my mind. So there are many similarities and definite distinctions radiated out, and a fluid situation existing in the mechanism of each one of us as we are working towards the higher rays. Let's just say there comes a time, I forget where he said this, but you know, it's probably rays initiation, when the man will discover that any ray is a limitation upon him. So he has reached that point where all where the rays, as we usually consider them, are a limitation. However, when he changes hierarchy and goes into a larger scope of being, the rays are with him again. And we know that the planetary logo, solar logo, cosmic logo, blah, 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 they all have their rays. So there is a point when you can rise above them all and manipulate them and make them your playthings. But then, once again, you are subject to them in a higher sense. Those are a few ideas, Walter.
Thank you.
I'm not sure it hit what you wanted, but in our life, they are fluid and we are changing. And when DK says, okay, you're a six-ray personality, you have a fourth-ray mind, he's taking a general average. See what I mean? He's not looking at all the minutiae of the sub-rays, which he could do in an exacting type of scientific study of the ego. He could do that. But, you know, let's realize who he's dealing with. He's dealing with us. So he has to simplify the thing and say, okay, six-ray personality, fourth-ray mind, second-ray astral, and that is not the totally articulated position of understanding. Okay, Walter.
We have a rather long question from Malia, which I'll read very slowly and kind
that,
of...
That's good, because my mind may not grok it, Malia, but let's see. Okay, go ahead.
So the first part of it is, do you have any idea of a timeline for humanity taking the first initiation?
Okay, let's stop right there. It's like asking, when will the Christ reappear? And I'm actually very serious about that, because DK has said, quote unquote, when the Christ reappears, it will indicate that humanity has taken the first initiation. And it, of course, it won't be all of humanity, but it will be a certain group within humanity that can uplift the whole. So I don't think, well, you know, I used to think it could be 2025, but the more I study this, the more I think we're going to have to enter the actual age of Aquarius, or at least later in the 21st century. You know, the Christ was already to have appeared at the end of the 20th century. There are indications in Initiation Human and Solar that the Christ was expected to materialize at that time. Of course, it wasn't until 1945 that we knew that the Christ would take a physical vehicle. So whatever the reappearance of the Christ might have been before that time, we don't know. However, Now, with atomic energy, the possibility that we can have bombs of a devastating nature in the hands of fanatics and so forth, that's delayed the whole business. So I guess they have so much to neutralize. My guess is that this first initiation of humanity is not going to occur for at least 100 years, which would mean that the Christ will not appear for at least 100 years. But, you know, he said, don't say this time or that time, lo here, lo there. You know, some teachers say, oh, he's in London and he's hiding and he's waiting for the press to discover him and all that nonsense. I just wouldn't ever commit myself because a certain proportion of development in humanity has to take place before the Christ can appear. So it's really up to us. We cannot say it's like a fixed date. Okay, what's the next part of the question?
Is this Pluto in Capricorn's potential destruction of the greed and cupidity of the world economic practices a yes. part of this first initiation process?
Yes. We have to learn how to share. That's one thing. And before the first initiation takes place, it's Pluto and Vulcan emerging into power. Now, of course, we have to learn how to stand with massed intent and with spiritual will. We haven't really learned how to do that quite yet. We certainly use Vulcan to create the armaments which kill each other. But let's just say Pluto and Vulcan must demonstrate in fullness, dragging to the surface all the filth, the hidden machinations, the ways people are manipulated. Yes, I would say Pluto in Capricorn is really part of the cleansing process, and wait till we get to Pluto in Aquarius. Aquarius, remember the labors of Hercules, the cleansing of the Augean stables, and Pluto dragging everything to the surface so that we can expiate it and be rid of it. That's going to be a tremendous environmental cleansing with Pluto in Aquarius starting around 2025, and the environment is also what's going on in us as well. So yes, I would say that financial collapse, realizing we can't do finance the way we have done it, it's all part of the preparation for the reappearance, which requires sharing, house cleaning, and peace, a certain measure of. Those are the three to-dos with respect to the reappearance of the Christ. A measure of sharing, the church has to clean house, but who is the church, you know? We all have to clean house. And then a measure of peace. We don't have it yet. Okay, the next part of the question?
Would this then be bringing, be the beginning of bringing an end to materialism?
Well, yes. DK said materialism is dead when the atom bomb went off. So basically with Einstein's formula, you know, coming in from a powerful fifth ray ashram, E equals MC squared, matter is light, is energy, the death of materialism, it just has to percolate through the thinking of everybody, and the new scientists are helping us do that. Materialism is on its way out, which is a way of saying that Pisceanism, as we've interpreted it, is on its way out, and a much more kind of ethereal view of matter as energy is going to make its presence understood in most of humanity. Materialism is dying. So it's just a question of how long it takes to give up the ghost. And I would say by the time we reach into the Aquarian Age, really by 2117 and so forth, you know, it's another 100 years ahead. So much of what we consider to be the materialistic way of perception will have really gone away. Already, you know, with the aura photography and the sensing of the etheric body and the Kirlian photography, the medical field is way ahead in all of this. Materialism is on its way out. But, you know, don't hold your breath. It's probably, you know, we'll have to come back and see it and maybe come back again for appreciable gains to be made. What else in the question?
Yvonne posed two questions. They're relatively short, so I'll give them to you together.
Okay, so that was the extent of Malia's question, right? Okay?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
The first one Yvonne asks is, will there be new seed groups like those that are described in the Dyna volumes? And the second one, are all the natural disasters an environmental cleansing?
Yeah, well, okay, look, the Seed Group project is a 275-year project, which was probably inaugurated in the year 1925. That means by the year 2200, it will have had its fulfillment. So DK lists different kinds of groups. The 10C groups are among the most important, but he also lists other places in externalization and maybe esoteric psychology, certain specialized kinds of groups that work in particular ways. These will be emerging. And I figure that DK will be one of the externalizing masters, and that this C group project, where he looks specifically to see taking form certain types of energy within a group, they will be his baby, and I think he's really going to develop them. I don't think we need to look for additional ones other than the ones that have been mentioned, because the ones that have been mentioned are so demanding anyway. So maybe there's 20 different kinds of groups that he's talked about, and somehow we will find our place in them during the next 200 years. Let's just say that we're almost to the point where the C group project is like 100 years old, almost. You know, when we reach 25, see, 1925 was such an important moment because the hierarchy, or a great percentage of it, moved its focus to the Buddhic plane. I believe the Master R became the Maha Chohan at that time, and many new possibilities. The seed of the new group of world servers, I think, was planted for inter-ashramic and inter-group dialogue. All that was happening at that time. But we've got 200 years still to go, and we will find our way, according to our inclination, into the seed group service, which is appropriate for us. And they will work in quite a subjective manner, but they will have good fruits externally in terms of how society reacts to the radiation of those magnetic seeds. Okay, and what was the second part of the question?
Are all the natural disasters we're seeing now part of this environmental cleansing?
Yes. What they have to do is awaken humanity to the consequences of its acts. Now, somewhere I've been hunting a long time, but DK says, look, things will come to such a pass that humanity will realize that alone and unaided, it cannot fully solve its problems, and then the hierarchy will be invoked. I feel we're really pushing the limit. We have a finite planet here. We have rampant capitalism and greed and selfishness and all that kind of thing. And the consequences of it have to become evident to people sufficiently so that they will keep themselves within due bounds and check their elemental nature. So, sometimes we look at global warming, for instance. Is it all man-made? I don't think it is. I think not all man-made, but partially. I think the axis of the Earth is in process of realigning its angle. There's been, I think DK said, there's been no true understanding of that alignment since Egyptian times, and there is an adjustment going on within the planetary logos himself as he takes a kind of fourth initiation through our particular globe and chain. So the planetary logos is part of this, and many of the kind of disasters that we feel are imminent are not entirely man-made, but they are definitely there. So I would say that the disasters will wake us up environmentally and help us come into alignment with the proper way of being stewards of the planet. And then, of course, the Manu is busy with the Agni Chaitans, and there are predicted earthquakes and all kinds of developments on the west coast of the United States and other places. This is all part of the plan, and we haven't seen anything yet, in my view.
We have another question, and I'm going to begin with Michael Stacey's thank you for taking on what is undoubtedly a large topic that he presents.
Okay. He's thanking me ahead of time.
Okay. I'm warning you. Could you elaborate on the three decanates of each sign, and how do we determine what each decanate is, the rulers, etc.?
Well, you know what I'm going to do about that, because it's like it's a whole unit of study. And, you know, what I would recommend, Michael, is to go to my work on esoteric astrology. I've done the entire book. I think Brett has got most of it up, and the or maybe all of it, I don't know. And the there are also introductions to each part of it. So what I'm going to do is show you a chart, which I'm very happy to send to you, okay? Because, you know, what you just asked is like a five-hour question, no doubt about it, and longer. Because I took at least an hour on each one of the decanate configurations for the signs, okay? But now I'm going to go to this particular chart, which, as I say, I'm happy to send you. And in this chart are all of my suppositions, also some of those of Nicholas Nilén, who's a very good student on these matters, also some of those which are belonging to Stephen Pugh, who's also very good on these things. And here are each one of them. There are the zodiacal constellations and the normal, Aries, it should be. The sub-elements, Aries Leo, Aries Sagittarius, and the colors appropriate. Then the extra zodiacal constellations are here. And Alice Bailey gave us these three extra zodiacal constellations, which are associated with every sign. And what we've done is associate one of them particularly with the first decanate, the second, and the third in every case. But in general, I would say that whoever is in Aries will be dealing with Cetus the monster, Cassiopeia the enthroned queen, and Perseus the hero. And here's what they're all about. Then here is a view that DK has given, somewhat on the wheel of consciousness, meaning the wheel turning in the clockwise direction. Just giving you an example, Venus or Jupiter. Jupiter is considered to be the ruler of the first decanate. Very strange, but that's what he gives. And then the Sun, the second decanate, and Mars, the third. Then the wheel of form reverses that whole thing. I also have some decanate wheels which are produced by Nicholas and by Stephen. They have differences, and I've tried to reconcile some of those. I've already, like I say, at the end of every one of the signs of the zodiac, in my esoteric astrology commentaries, I've spent a lot of time discussing the decanates. This is the wheel of form according to Nicholas, which is pretty much what the Tibetan has. Now here are the Alan Leo decanates, which are different and reversed from what the Tibetan has. And here we have Mars as the ruler of the first decanate and Jupiter as the ruler of Sagittarius, the last decanate. But that's not what the Tibetan says, and I tried to explain why. And then we have the Sepharial method, which basically begins with Mars and moves towards the Sun and down to the Moon, and then goes back out to Saturn, and I justify all of these things. Now, here is, you know, all the rest of the signs are found here. And I also have, what I'd like to find for you, if I could, is I give an analysis of each one of the signs of the zodiac in every single decanate. In other words, how they approach from 30 degrees to 20, 20 degrees to 10, 10 degrees to 0 on the clockwise wheel, and then move from 0 to 10, 10 to 20, and 20 to 30, and I write up an analysis for every one of those positions. Now, I tell you what, I think what I should do is just send you my material. There's a lot of it. And to deal with this subject in the proper way would take hours and hours. As a matter of fact, I think it would take about 24 hours to really go through everything and justify why Sepharial may be correct sometimes. He's correct for Gemini and he's correct for Cancer, but he's not correct other times. Why is that? So I get into all that. Alan Leo is mostly correct, but not entirely correct. The wheel of consciousness is valid for people like ourselves on the reverse wheel or reversing wheel, but the wheel of form is not to be ignored. And so you've just like opened up a whole book. That's all I can say. And the best that I can do, is send you the pertinent documents and why I think they are there. Now, they're already spelled out in the esoteric astrology webinars that I've done. At the end of every sign are the decanates. And probably when you go on Makara and you look at what program fits with what thing, you'll see the programs which deal with the decanates. And the charts that I use are on the screen, and so you'll be able to read them. But I'm not really able to do what you asked because it is a huge number of hours involved in it. I guess that's all I could say for the moment. Are there any complaints? It's all I can do because, you know, otherwise we would be here. I'm not all night, but into next day and the next day and the next day. So that is the issue. Okay, Michael? Is that okay for the moment? And if it's, yeah, okay, so I'll unmute you, Mike, or you can speak if you want.
Yes, this is Michael. I thought it might be a large topic, and I appreciate what you told me and how I am able to find the information, and from that I think I'm able to use it.
Yeah, it's a huge topic. You know, basically what I do is I go to the end of every chapter where DK talks about the decanates, and I analyze what he said. Then I turn to this chart, and then I do something else, and I wonder if I can show you what one of these things looks like, so you get the idea. Sixfold charts, I call them. Okay, so now the second type of chart you're going to get is this, and it is an analysis of the movement counterclockwise first towards the green flower and counterclockwise towards the blue flower, which means in the direction of the soul. And then underneath it, I talk about the man who is physical, emotional, mental, aspirational, the disciple and soul, and maybe somewhere initiatic. And I take every single decanate and I talk about it in terms of the six types of people that there are. So as you can see, there's like 18 different descriptions according to the level of evolution at which you find yourself. And I do this for each of the signs. So what you basically asked about is basically a book. And of course, no one has the final answer, but I'm happy to send to you what, you know, these things, and they are also available in the esoteric astrology webinars. So, you know, I'll send you this stuff, and if it's useful to you, I think it might be, then, you know, you can use it, of course. Okay, are we good there, Michael? Are we good?
Yeah, I think that's marvelous. Thank you so much.
Okay, very good, very good. I'll send that to you. Just send me your email address, or Joe or Kay, send me the email address, and I'll send off these 24 documents. Okay, that's what they are.
We will do. We have your email address, Michael. We'll get that to Michael Robinson. If there's anyone else,
okay, very good. Thank you.
Should know.
Okay, are there other questions on whatever? Basically, you know, it's a free for all. We can, you know, I don't understand all aspects of the ageless wisdom with equal acuity, let me assure you. But if I don't know something, I know somebody who knows more than I do, so I can direct you to them. But meanwhile, at least I have thoughts from having studied this stuff for 50 years in this life anyway, so I'm happy to give you my thoughts. Any further questions or anything that you might want to discuss? Okay, are we, yeah? I would just like to say, you know, that I'm very grateful for your participation in the Moria Federation, those of you who are and participating, and those of you who are thinking of doing it, well, that's great. We have to train ourselves. I'm remembering someone saying, you know, to Master DK, essentially, this is the story. The man says to DK, use me. And DK says, what makes you sure you're so sure you're useful? So, I mean, I'm boiling it down just a little bit. Maybe he was more politic than that. But we have to train ourselves. You know, remember Alice Bailey said, the meek shall inherit the earth. It doesn't mean the timid, the futile, those who lack will. The word meek, says Alice Bailey, means the trained. Those who are trained shall inherit the earth. Now, we have in esoteric Buddhism, we have with what DK has given us in Agni Yoga, in Blavatsky's work, we have what we need. It's just a question of whether we really will apply this to our life, really take the time, you know, to focus in the light-filled mind and increase the quotient of light, and add to our mental understanding first. Then with Venus, the heart will expand with the mental understanding, and with Vulcan, the spiritual will come in, and we will become useful. You know, the world needs the ageless wisdom like never before. And we are people who at least are interested in it and have the opportunity to convey it to others. So our usefulness to the divine plan and to the hierarchy and to those that the plan serves can be real thing if we will take the steps that will make us useful in the esoteric and also the practical sense. Any thoughts?
Well, we have one more question from Yvonne.
Yes, okay, yes.
Her question is, who is the master of the third ray? And I believe she means the third ray ashram.
Paul the Venetian. My wife used to call him Paul the Venusian. I don't know, not that's all quite right, but Paul the Venetian, what's his name? Veronese. He was an artist and a thinker, and I think did he live in, what is the city in Italy which has the waterways? You know, Venice, okay. I think that was one of his important places, and he is the master of the third ray ashram now at this time. And DK sometimes talks about, you know, the business and the philosophy and the work with the workers and all that kind of thing. And there are other third ray masters. There's an English third ray master who's very active, too. He's not the head, he's not the Chohan of the third ray. Now, let's also be clear about this. The master R is now working on the third ray. Of course, his soul ray is the seventh, but he is the Maha Chohan, and so, in a way, he's the head of the entire third ray process. And what I'm going to do is, you know, show you something that you already maybe know. Let's see, where am I here? Okay, right over here. Okay, so let's look back over here at the structure of the hierarchy. And here we have the Venetian master, Paul the Venetian. Okay, Venice, okay. And the master Serapis, the master Hilarion, the master Jesus, and an unnamed seventh ray master. Here is the Maha Chohan, who is now the master R, and he's one of the three great lords, and he is accountable directly to Shambhala. But he's got a third ray monad, of course. The Christ is a second ray monad, of course. The Manu has a first ray monad, of course. So some people just say, well, Master R is just working on the seventh ray, and that's incorrect, because he's holding in the third ray all of these other masters and their work. Of course, the seventh ray is emphasized, so he is particularly emphasizing the seventh ray at this time. And you can, you know, kind of look up here and probably find Saturn in relation to other planets here embracing these higher beings, just the way the Master R is embracing all of this. And there are other beings here that surround the sun, and each one of them works through three planets. So go to Esoteric Psychology, page 99 or so, and I think you will find the story of Saturn, Mars, and the Earth, with this being containing them, and then with the second being, we will have Uranus, Venus, and Jupiter, and with the third being, it's not discussed, but we will probably have Vulcan and Pluto and Neptune, and leaving Mercury free as the intermediary. So everything that's happening up here is reflected in what our hierarchy does, more or less. Maybe not exactly so, but pretty much. And the three Buddhas of activity here around Sanakumara have a higher correspondence in the three persons of the Logoic Trinity. So this is a very important map and gives you an idea of the rays and the relationships. Just follow those lines and you will find some amazing things about who's working alone and who's working together. You know, a lot of, it's kind of interesting, look at Master DK here. Let's just say that, what have we got here, who is this? Master Moria is directly related to him. So is the Manu, but Master Jupiter is not. And why is that? Well, the Maha Chohan has a line straight to Master DK, that's Master R, and so does the whole Christ line, of course. But why are there certain lines there and not certain lines? Study that carefully. Okay,
there's a follow-up question from Malia related to the chart. She asks,
yes.
do you have any idea, or do we have any idea, who the seventh ray master is?
I don't. We have people claiming to be that master. We even had him at our conference, but you know, that doesn't really make the master. I do have, you know, he did talk about a certain master on the fourth ray, a certain Master P, and I think that I got the hint on that this is the Master Polydorus Isserenius of the Brotherhood of Luxor, Master P, Polydorus, along with Tutuit Bey and an Englishman by the name of Robert Ward, fourth-ray Master P. But in terms of this seventh-ray Master, no. I have no idea and certainly no accurate idea. I just know that there's one that's needed and the position is being filled. And, you know, there's some of these Masters have kind of veils over what they're doing and where they're working. And all of that is quite deliberate. And I'm just assuming that such is the case with this unknown, temporarily unknown, seventh ray master. Best I can do, Malia. Anything else, friends? Because we are pretty much at our time. Pretty much at our time, you know, an hour and a half or so. Well, look, you know, I think we'll be, we are recording this, and we will send it out to the student body, I believe, and also we can send it out to others. This is an open webinar, and they can have the benefit of your questions and such responses as they were, and we can do this again sometimes. Every once in a while, there's a little clearing in the schedule. Our webinar schedule is getting very full these days. But we can have a clearing, and then we can just invite everybody to offer their questions. So think of the things that... now, look, you know, I've got to say this. When you have a question, you really got to work on it, right? I mean, the first thing you have to do is inquire the way. It means that you ask yourself the question, and then you attempt the best you can to answer it. But further than that, you know, obviously additional light on certain questions can always be helpful, and that's what I'm trying to do, assuming that you also have the earnestness to inquire the way on your own. The most important thing, said the Buddha, is self-reliance. That was the whole theme of his final sermon. So, you know, from another point of view, nobody can teach anybody anything. You know, it's a question of what you're ready to absorb and what your intuition is ready to recognize. It's all self-effort. So the Buddha said, rely upon yourself. Well, interesting, who is the self, you know? It's like relying upon the universe. It's like relying upon the one source to which you are really connected. The you think you are is really this greater being. So when you rely upon yourself, you're relying upon this great all-infusing being. But that's the thing, you know, take the question yourself first, and then when you seek additional light, that additional light can be forthcoming. Well, I think what we'll do here, we can all appreciate your presence, and, you know, we'll close with this mantra of the new group of world servers. And I think I can find it. There it is. Okay. Excuse me. And when we reach the point where we use the word I, let's use the word we. You know, let's keep it in the group consciousness, even though there's a sense in which I can be the all-inclusive I, you know, the one being. But we're not there yet, mostly, right? So we use the word we because we're cultivating this group consciousness. So we'll have an om at the beginning and an om at the end, and then it will be a farewell. By the way, one thing I wanted to mention. Look, Rick Gooden and I need some help in devising the personal identity profile number 3, PIP 3. We need you to take this new test, which has more questions on it. It's called, if you can go to PIP2online.com. Maybe I'll just write it out here so you'll know what I'm talking about. Looks like this. PIP2online.com or PIP2online.com. And or write to Rick and to me. I hope you'll help us with this, because this is, it's called Contact PIP2 Online. And I'll give you this. This is the other, there it is, Contact at PIP2 Online. And help us improve this test. We're trying to find some good questions and some questions that are not so good. We want to see what is not working statistically. So if you'll be so kind as to join in and take the test, it will help us a lot. So you have the places where you can write to do that. And, you know, it doesn't cost you anything, I think, at this point to take the test. You're a beta tester. And when it comes asked for your contribution, you say beta tester, something like that. And then you can, that's your contribution to the process. And hopefully by the time of the next conference, which will be on the number 8 and Mercury and so forth, we will have our PIP3 ready to go with the help of students like yourself, if you'd be so kind. Okay. So, here we are. May the power of the one life pour through the group of all true servers. May the love of the one soul characterize the lives of all who seek to aid the great ones. May we fulfill our part in the one work through self-forgetfulness, harmlessness, and right speech. Thank you, everybody, and we'll unmute you so you can say goodbye if you like. And I'll start from the bottom. Brett, if you start from the top, I'll start from the top, bottom, top, bottom, whatever. Get everybody unmuted so you can say farewell. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, you bet, Michael. You bet. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah.
Thank
well,
you,
nice
Michael.
To have you here, and we'll do
Thank
this
you, and
again.
Bye, everyone.
We'll do this again.
Bye.
Bye-bye, Walter. Michael, send me that. I'll get that stuff to you. I'll put you on the list. Okay, farewell.
Nice to be with you, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, thank you so much, Maribel. Bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.